name is John Horan. I'm here at Judson Park with Terry Maher, and I'm here with, can you say your name?
Helen Moise.
Can you spell it?
H-E-L-E-N-M-O-I-S-E.
And today's date?
March the 17th, 2014.
All right, and your birthday, please?
December 1st, 1933.
Okay, it all sounds good to me. All right, can you tell me where you were born?
I was born in Akron, Ohio at St. Thomas Hospital, which is still there.
Oh, yeah?
St. Thomas, yeah.
How long were you in Akron?
I was in Akron until 1962, and then that's when I came to Cleveland.
Okay, so what did you do in Akron?
In Akron, when I graduated from Buchtel High, I went to Akron U for a year, and then I went to Kent State University, and I graduated from Kent State with a degree in business and home economics. They don't even have such a thing today as home economics because nobody knows what it is.
What was it?
Well, in those days, that was where women, when they went to college, that's what they did. They didn't go into math or engineering or law or the things that they do today. In those days, the jobs were in places like East Ohio Gas Company or the electric company, where we used to what we called pitch gas or pitch electric. We were the electric company and East Ohio Gas were competitors. And we were trying to sell gas ranges where I worked, and we would go to different clubs, women's clubs, and pitch gas. We would cook a meal, and we had different recipes that we would give out, and how best to use a gas range, and it was just, you know. And then the next thing you'd know, we'd be in like a Sears and Roebuck or in a department store, and we'd give demonstrations there. We went to schools, and we gave demonstrations to kids in the eighth grade, and because we knew, you know, they were going to be going to high school and then college, hopefully, and eventually would be getting married, and we wanted them to use a gas range, not electric. Now there is no such thing as that today. That's gone. You can't even go to a college and find home economics. It's just not there.
How did you find the job at
I heard that there was an opening in Canton, Ohio, so I spent a year there. And I lived in a private home, and where they had, because in Canton at that time, they didn't have a apartment or, you know, high rises or any places to rent. So I had a room in a private home, and I had my own little kitchen, and then across the hall was another lady who worked somewhere else in Canton. And then there was a guy in another room, and since I had the kitchen, I did all the cooking, and they came, and we had dinner there. And so I was there for a year, and then there was an opening in Akron so that I could go live with my parents. And so I did that, and then I heard about a friend of mine called me, the gal that I worked with in Canton, had a job at the Plain Dealer in the home economics department there. She wrote about food and recipes in the paper and that kind of thing. And she called me and she said, there's an opening at the Cleveland Press, which was the opposite paper, the afternoon paper, and it was the biggest paper in Ohio. And so I said, well, geez, I don't know anything about journalism. I never took a journalism, so I don't think that would be. She says, if I can do it, you can do it. So I went, and I was interviewed by Florence LeGank, who was a well-known food editor, because during the Depression, when everybody was out of work and making no money, she made a bloody fortune because she wrote about food and recipes in 125 different papers. She was syndicated, so she made a whole lot of money. And so anyway, there was this opening, and I went to interview with her, and she took me into the managing editor's office, and he said, "Why do you want to write?" And I said, "Because I don't know anything about it." And he just sort of sat back, and he says, "Well, if you don't know anything about it, how do you think you're going to..." I says, "Well, I'm bored. I'm bored with my job. I did it, you know, at East Ohio, and I liked it, but I got bored. And when I'm bored, I want something I don't know anything about." And so they said, "Okay, well, we'll call you in a month." And so then she called me in 2 weeks and said, "How would you like to work for me in Cleveland?" And that's when I said, "Boy, the other three must have really been bad, you know." And she laughed. And she was 82 years old. And
when was this?
This was in 1962.
Okay.
And this is February 7th, 1962 is when I came to Cleveland. And I moved in with four other gals in a private home in Cleveland Heights, and on the corner of Mayfield and Overlook. Just you could walk down to Little Italy, which is where we spent a lot of time going to restaurants and stuff. And we had a nice pool in the back. And so we had a lot of visitors because we were real popular because we had a pool. So we always had a lot of dates because they wanted to come and use the pool. So I was there for, I think, 4 years. And then I moved to Shaker on Kemper Road across from the skating club. And
what's the skating club?
The skating club is across the street from where I lived on Kemper. The skating club is still, it's still there. It's a very posh club.
What is it? What do?
Skate. They have a swimming pool. They have, it's been a long time since I've been there. It was at that time a private, like a country, it was like a country club, only they focused on skating, and they used to have events there where people would skate and compete for contests and make money and that kind of thing. I don't think you have to. I think you can belong there now without being totally loaded with money. But I haven't been there for quite a while, because at the time I was going there, a friend of mine belonged to it, and so she always invited me to the different things. They have a lot of things going on there all the time. But I haven't been there since she died a few years ago. So
so you lived across the street?
I lived across the street there for about 4 years, and then I moved to Shaker Square into a condo, which was across from Moreland Courts. I always called it, when you couldn't afford to live at Moreland Courts anymore, you moved across the street where I lived. Because Moreland Courts is still the most expensive place you can live. And it used to be apartments, now it's condos. And it costs you a bloody fortune to live there. And ours were, they were apartments, but then they turned into condos. So then I bought a condo there. And I lived there until May the 11th, 2011, when I moved to Judson, to Garden View, because I had injured my back and I couldn't move a sweeper, I couldn't lift a book, I couldn't do anything. So I came here for therapy, for 3 months therapy, because I had, they always sent as soon as you were a senior citizen, you'd get stuff from Judson and all these other places, you know, come do your therapy and blah, blah, blah. So I did 3 months therapy thinking that I was going to go back to my apartment. And the therapist kind of screwed up my back. So I ended up staying here, and that's why I'm here.
So I want to go back to when you first go to Cleveland Heights. Why did you pick Cleveland Heights?
Because I had some friends who lived in this double house. The landlord lived on one side, and we lived on the other. And I had the I was up on the third floor in the attic, third floor. So I had my own bathroom and everything. So it was very nice. And there were five of us living there. And one was the other one worked for the plane dealer, and then I worked, you know, at the press. And the other one was a school teacher. And so, I mean, we were all friends.
Yeah. Well, were you aware of any of the political goings on in Cleveland Heights at the time, with integration, for example?
Well, at that time, there wasn't a whole lot about that then. I mean, they people didn't change. For instance, it was predominantly white. It really hadn't changed then, and it's like Shaker Square was totally white, and then people started moving in on Buckeye Road, which used to be all Hungarian. And they had these nice little manicured homes and wonderful Hungarian restaurants on Buckeye Road. And we used to go to those all the time. And then they all got rich, so they left. And the whole neighborhood changed. And Shaker Square has never been the same. I mean, I used to walk around Shaker Square because they had wonderful stores there. Now it's mostly restaurants, and most of them are not open until evening. But you wouldn't walk around there by yourself at night. It's too scary.
Mm-hmm. Well, so were you involved with the Ludlow Community Association or no?
No, I had friends who lived on Ludlow, mm-hmm. but I lived on the corner of Van Aken and Shaker Square Boulevard.
Okay, so you
I mean, we had parties. You know, there were a lot of parties that they'd have every year, and that was fun. Mm-hmm. And we had meetings.
What do you remember of those parties and meetings?
Well, it was a whole different group of people. We didn't have baggy pants with rear ends sticking out. And we used to go, you know, always go to the theater at night and walk home. Like I'd walk I lived on Kemper across from the skating club. And that was not a problem, just walking around the square from there. And then when I bought my condo, it was, you know, pretty good, and then all of a sudden it just changed because of what happened in Buckeye Road. And you don't walk around there in the daytime, it's scary. Which is a shame.
So let's go back to your employment with the press. Mm-hmm. So can you tell me a little bit about the press and the plane dealer, how they...
Oh, we were really the press was the biggest paper in Ohio, and because it was an afternoon paper, and things changed, more people were getting they were you know more people were out working, and weren't getting the afternoon paper. They wanted on the way to work, they wanted to read the morning paper. So we were noted for all the advertising. The press, Cleveland Press, had all the advertising, and we were making all the money. But then things changed. More women were working, and the economy got really bad. That what they were trying to do was clean up the air. So what happened was Republic Steel tried to clean up the air, and they spent so much money they went out of business. And because that's where all the money was. People who had jobs in those industries made a lot of money, and they lived in nice manicured homes. And when that changed, now, you know, people are on computers, and they do other, they're not making the same kind of money that these hard-working people made. I mean, they're in restaurants, and I mean, they don't make much money. So the economy started to go down, so then people quit buying the afternoon paper because they wanted a paper to read in the morning. So we went out of business June the 21st, 1982. And Tom Vail, who at the time was the editor and I think also the owner of the Plain Dealer, he was the publisher and editor. And I had heard that he made an announcement, we're not hiring anybody from the Cleveland Press. That's out. So I thought, So I called, and I said, I know you're not hiring anybody, but I did food, I did restaurant reviews, and I ended up doing society. I was society editor. I was in the promotion department after I was associate food editor. They were getting rid of people at the press. So they asked me if I'd go into the public relations department. I said, I don't know anything about that, but okay, yeah. So I went, and I did. I was head of the Cuyahoga County Spelling Bee. I was head of book and author events. I brought authors from all over the country, plus England, you know, France, whatever. And I really loved that because I was meeting all these famous writers, and I had to entertain them and take them to restaurants and interview them and get them interviewed. Take them around to all the radio and TV stations, because at that time, all the radio stations and all the TV stations were competing with each other, and they'd say, "Oh, I hear so and so is coming to town. Can we interview that person?" And I'd say, "Sure." And then somebody else, Channel 8, would call and say, "Whoa, how come you didn't call us? We want him." And I said, "Well, I can bring him over there, you know, later." And so I would pick them up at the airport, bring them back to the hotel, and then I'd pick them up early in the morning and take them around to all the radio and TV stations for interviews, and then they would speak at the Renaissance Hotel, and I'd get, you know, quite a few people coming to these events, and they'd buy their books. And right now on television, I watch the book television, where they have authors come in and get interviewed, and then they give a speech, and then there's an audience, which is just like what I did. And then they, at the end of their speech, then they hope to sell their book and sign it. So I watch that all the time because I see some of my authors, but now they're gray. They used to were young. But it's fun, you know. It's.
Do you have a standout memory of an author, a story of their visit?
Or? Yeah, one of my favorite authors was Fay Weldon, who just wrote a book like Downton Abbey. When you see the cover of the book, it looks like a Downton Abbey story. But she's the first person who ever did Upstairs, Downstairs, which you're too young to remember. But you remember Upstairs, Downstairs. She wrote that.
Okay.
And when I found out...
What is it?
Pardon me?
It is Upstairs, Downstairs.
Upstairs, Downstairs is a British series. I forget how many years it was on. And now it's Downton Abbey.
Oh, I see.
It was one of the most popular shows. I mean, those Brits really know how to do things right.
Tell them the setting of those stories, of Upstairs, Downstairs.
It's very much like Downton Abbey, if you've ever watched that. It's, you know, the downstairs where the chefs and the maids and they'd eat downstairs, and they'd have a big long table, and they would eat downstairs, and then they'd serve this lavish dinner upstairs to all the hoi polloi, you know, which is exactly like a Downton Abbey. And right now, Downton Abbey is probably one of the most popular shows. And I can't wait for the new, I've already seen them a few times over, but I can't wait for the new one to start, which won't be for quite a while yet.
So Fay Weldon.
Yeah. Fay Weldon came, and this is a really funny story. She's my age. Okay, and at that time I was like 60, maybe just 60. And it had taken me 10 years to get her because I had read all her books, and they're a riot. And they're very much, she was titled, billed as the Jane Austen of the 20th century. And what made her famous was she said in her novels what Jane Austen never said. In other words, if you watched any of the Jane Austen TV shows, everybody always met under a tree where they made out, you know, made love, and somebody always said, oh, you know, I want you to marry me. And it was always the same thing over and over and over. And they never really told the truth what they were really thinking, whereas Fay Weldon says, I mean, you want to read every paragraph because you think, uh-oh, what is she going to say that's really funny? And what's he really thinking? So that's what made hers so different. And it took me 10 years to get her because I said, I'd read all her books. I want her here. And they said, well, we can't afford to send her because she's in England and she won't come without her husband. And I said, oh, I really, really have to, I really have to have her. So I got her. And so the day that I'm picking she and her husband, Fay and her husband, whose name is Nick Fox, she called me up and she said, we can't come in until a certain time because our plane has just been canceled. And she called me at, like 2 o'clock in the morning or something. And she said, we won't be in Cleveland until 5:30 in the morning. I says, I don't care. I've waited long enough to get you. You call me as soon as you hit Cleveland, and I'll be there to pick you both up. Okay. I said, you call me when you get here, and then go straight to the hotel, and then we'll have lunch. At 1 o'clock, I'll meet you in the lobby of the hotel, both of you. And we'll meet there for lunch, but you at least have some hours sleep. So she says, okay. So she did call me at 5:30, and I said, okay, I'm glad you're here. I'll see you at lunch. So I'm sitting in, this is really funny. I'm sitting in the lobby of the Renaissance, and she comes down, and I introduce myself, and I said, "Where's your husband?" She, "Oh, he's coming. He'll be right down." So we're sitting there talking. I said, "Well, where is he?" And she said, "Oh, he just got off the elevator. He's coming right now." And I keep looking, and I look, and I'm looking, and here's this young guy who's 20 years younger than she is, and his name is Nick Fox. And she said, "Oh, here he is." I said, "That's your husband?" And she says, "Yeah, he's a lot younger." I said, "Yeah, I can see that because you and I are the same age." "Yeah, okay." You know, it was so funny. And he was wonderful. And he had heard about the Cleveland Art Museum. He says, "I hear you have a great museum." And I says, "Yeah." And I said, "We have a really great show there right now." And I said, "It's all 18th century artists." And he says, "Oh, I'd love to see it." And I said, "Okay." I said, "I'll take you there. I'll drop you off. And then I'll see you at such and such a time when your wife starts to speak. And then you take a cab back." And he said, "Okay, he'd do that." So he goes, and it's time for the book and author dinner to start, and I don't see him. And I have a place for him to sit right in the front. And I said, "Where is Nick Fox? He should be here, because I'm in the back. And I said, "Well, come up. Here's a seat for you." He said, "Well, I didn't want to disturb you. I just happened to get in a little late." I said, "Well, come sit in the front." So anyway, she gets up to speak, and she says, "I don't care what great college you go to, I don't care how many writing courses you take, but if you haven't lived, you cannot write. And I have lived." And, you know, she was on her third husband, and then this one's 20 years younger. The first one she married was like a real old man. I mean, really old. He was an antique dealer. And she had gone to, she and her mother and sister had to go to, it was either New Zealand or Australia, one of the two places, because her father was a doctor during World War II, and he was over there. So they took a boat over, and the father started playing around with another woman. And her mother found out and she said, "Well, if he's going to cheat on me, I'm going to find my guy." So she found a guy, went out with him, and when her husband found out that she had cheated on him, he says, "We're getting a divorce." It was okay for him to cheat, but not for her. Mm-hmm. So she says, "Well, then we're leaving." So they got on a boat and went back to England during, you know, World War II, and bombs are flying all around, and they had to move into this basement apartment where there were rats and mice and bugs and all kinds, but that's the way things were in England then. And so anyway, it was quite, I mean, she had lived, and so she could write things. But this was her third husband, Faye Weldon's third husband. The first two were real old. And the second oldest one, she thought, "Oh, this marriage is really great." And they'd been married like 27 years. And then she found out he was cheating. She thought she had the perfect marriage, and so then she got rid of him, and then she married this young guy. So she's my favorite writer. I've read 28 of her books.
Quite a few.
Yeah.
So you said.
But she's my favorite.
So you said that you were working hard to get her over.
Yeah, it took me 10 years.
Yeah.
Because I had read all these books.
How did you finally do it?
Well, I just said, "Look, you know, I've read all of them. I want her. I've wanted her. And we'll get 200 people there. It's going to sell all kinds of books. She's going to be well known. You know, Cleveland has the biggest book and author luncheons in the country. And you're crazy not to send her. So they did. And see, now they have book and author events, the public library. But they have to pay like $20,000 for these authors.
You also have to pay
$35 to get in. Ours was, oh God, I can't even remember. It was not very much. I think for 20 or 25, you got dinner and the event. Three authors. I had three authors at each one. Yeah. And we didn't pay the authors. We paid them nothing. We paid for the Renaissance and while they were here, but we didn't pay them for speaking. So, you know, I have to laugh at the ones now that, because I had Tom Friedman 1 year.
Say who he is.
New York Times. Oh, God, the Lord, yeah. He's syndicated in the Plain Dealer, and in many other papers.
He
writes about
any opinion.
Yeah, he's an opinion writer. You know, he's not a liberal and he's not a conservative. He's sort of down the center, and he's a real sensible guy. And I got him for free, and he charges $60,000 to speak, but I got him for free because we gave him so much publicity, because I ran a full page ad in the paper several times a week in the Plain Dealer.
Oh, in the Plain Dealer.
Yeah, and I'd have the three authors, three for each month. It was 4 months. And big pictures of them and a little synopsis of their book and so on. So they got a lot of publicity, which the other people didn't.
What decade were you doing this?
This was from 1983 to 2002. Yeah, I was there 20. I was a freelancer at the Plain Dealer.
All 20 years.
When I told them what I did, because they weren't hiring anybody from the press when the press went out of business. And I told them what I did. I said, you know, I did the Cuyahoga Spelling Bee, Cuyahoga County, and the book and author event. And they said, oh, we've always wanted that book and author event, but you can only come for 1 year. I said, well, 1 year is better than none. I need a job. And so I came and stayed for 20 because they never told me not to come back.
There you go.
And so I worked under four different editors. And I made them look good because I wrote all the speeches to introduce the authors. So, you know, for them to stand up and introduce these famous people, you know, that made them look good. Mm-hmm. So I kept my job until I was 69 and retired.
And then what happened to that author series?
They have one. Well, I went to the Cuyahoga County Library.
Okay.
I mean, it's, what's her name? Can't think of her name. I should know it. She's doing it, but the, you know, they charge a big amount and you don't get dinner.
Yeah.
And plus, they pay them. You know, 20,000, 60,000, whatever.
How did you get it paid for? I mean,
we didn't pay him.
We
gave them all the so much publicity.
And so they sold a lot of books.
Oh yeah.
And then did the people that attended pay to get in to have their dinner? You said how much?
Oh yeah, it wasn't very much, like $25.
Okay.
And
where did you have them?
At the Renaissance.
Mm-hmm. Always.
Mm-hmm.
And how often?
Once a month. Well, for 4 months.
4 months a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then And then I did, there were people from Akron who used to come. And this one, a friend of mine who was very active with Our Lady of the Elms, which is a private Catholic girls' school for the Dominican nuns, they used to come. One of the nuns used to come with this gal, and she said, you know, we'd like you to do a book and author series for us. And I said, Akron? And they said, yeah. I said, oh. And I said, well, I can try it. And I thought, got to drive him to Akron and pick him up at the airport, drive him to Akron, drive him, blah, 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 blah. Well, I did it for 17 years. To raise money for the school. And they're Dominican nuns who live in a palace in Akron. It used to be some big mansion owned by I forget who. But, I mean, it really was nice. They lived very high off the hog. And they still have them. But they get local authors, you know, people from Akron or Cleveland. Not people from all over. But they, you know, it raises money for the schools.
Who was, so Faye was your favorite. Who was the, who do you think got the most attention? You know, who
well,
packed the seats?
I had my, well, I love the historians. And I had the guy who did, the famous book on Hitler and can't think of his name.
We'll talk about him, and his name will come. I love the historians, the famous book.
Oh, God, yeah, it was the Third Reich, the rise and fall of the Third Reich.
Mm-hmm.
How can I forget that?
Welcome.
Look up the author. It's probably here.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's here. But yeah, I was to get him. That was a real coup because he wasn't very well, and he was old. And I said, "Oh, I'll take good care of him. Don't worry about it. Just bring him here. I'll take good care of him." And so, when I picked him up at the airport, he says, "I bet you didn't think I'd make it." And I said, "Well, I told you I'd take care of you." And we had the best time because I had Rosalind Carter at the same time. Because Jimmy Carter had just, you know, lost the election. So Rosalind wrote a book titled The Lady from Plains. And Herman, the one who did the Third Reich.
Is that Herman Wouk?
Herman Wouk. No.
Okay.
No, I think I had him too.
Go ahead. So this story about...
He was so excited to meet Rosalind Carter. He was so excited, and he really, you know, because I got them both together, I did have 2,000 people, and they sold a lot of books. And the people went nuts over Rosalind Carter. They just, The Lady from Plains, it was called. And people stopped her on the street, and she hugged them. And I mean, it was just unbelievable. They just loved her. And I told her, I said, maybe you should run for president. And one of the funniest things I remember, Town Hall of Cleveland at that time was one of my accounts, because I was freelancing. And they were one of my accounts. And, of course, they brought all these big names. Ex-presidents, and they brought in Margaret Thatcher. Wow. What a day that was. And she stayed at the Renaissance. And I was freelancing for them, and I was their PR person because the press had folded, and I was doing, you know, freelance for the Plain Dealer, so they wanted to know if I was interested in working for them. I said, sure, because they were the ones that paid big bucks to get people because they charged a lot. And they brought in Margaret Thatcher, and I said, oh, my God. So when I went to pick her up, it was my job to keep the press away from her, and nobody was allowed to touch her, shake her hands, nothing. And you couldn't get, and here I am working for a newspaper, and I had to keep the press away because everybody wanted to talk to her, and nobody was allowed to, you know. So then I got her, and I was not allowed to ride in her limo. She was the only one allowed in the limo, and I had to take a cab and go behind her because she was speaking at, I don't know whether it was the Palace or one of the big theaters downtown, because it was bigger than the Renaissance. I mean, they had that many people. And so I said, how am I going to do this? So I said to the cab, I said, follow that limo. Well, my cab broke down. And here I am, I'm going crazy. What am I going to do? So I get out of the cab, and somebody who knew me, who was going to see her, said, hey, what? Come on, we'll take you. So they drove me up. Lucky. Yeah, I was so lucky. And anyway.
Was she prime minister at the time?
She was, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And then they had a party for her at the, I believe, it was at the, club downtown on, across from the old Statler. Not the in-town club, the big, oh, sure, you know it. Not the in-town. It's the country, it's a what's
what street is it on?
It's right there on 12th. Oh my God, it's 12th and Euclid. We got to find that out. I mean, it's the richest men's club. No, not Rofont.
Union Club?
Union Club. There you go. Union Club. Yeah, it was at the Union Club. So they had a reception there for her. And I had to keep all these people away from her again.
She didn't travel with an entourage?
No. But you were not allowed to be.
You were not allowed to be? She didn't travel with an
entourage? Yeah, I mean... No, I mean, you just weren't allowed to be in the same cab with her.
Right. Yeah. But how come she didn't have security to sort of keep people at bay?
Well, we just put these, you know, the whoever was there had to put the, you know, the tape around her, mm-hmm. so that nobody would shake her hands.
And this was, so tell us the decade or around?
It had to be
Jimmy Carter had been.
Yeah, Jimmy Carter had been there.
And not reelected. That was 70.
70s. I don't remember. I think it was the 70s.
Jimmy Carter was
not reelected, and Reagan went in for the first time.
80.
So it was 1980.
Yeah.
80.
Well, whenever she was in.
She was in charge. Thatcher?
Thatcher.
In charge almost exactly the same time as Reagan, so right around 80 to about 92.
Yeah, so it had to be. Yeah, I couldn't tell you the exact date. You could find out. I don't know, the same people, the people who run town hall now wouldn't remember. The ones that did then are dead. Peggy Meldrum and Ginny Jones, I think her name.
Yeah.
They're dead.
Going back to when you first started at the press, all the way back then.
Yeah.
And you said your friend at the PD, Plain Dealer, said apply for this job at the press.
Right.
Did you experience any difficulty from being a woman in the field?
No, because it was in the food department. And that was mostly, now the food editor at the Plain Dealer is a guy. At that time, I mean, we were probably, I would say we got more calls than anybody else at the newspaper, because everybody eats.
Yeah, sure.
And I never had time, you're supposed to drink a lot of water and all that kind of stuff to stay healthy. I never had time to go to the John. My arm was like this. I would say 200 to 300 calls a day.
Oh, reaching for the phone constantly.
I'm like this. And I got to the point where I could just go like that and it would drop right on the, right there. It was
200 or 300 calls a day.
Unbelievable. And one of the funniest stories. I had a friend of mine, Connie Cutlip, who worked in the advertising department at Higbee's. And she lived at Shaker Square, and we were good friends. And she was calling me. It was at Thanksgiving time. And she didn't call me. It was somebody else who called me who I thought was Connie. And this woman calls and says, how do you stuff a turkey? And I thought it was Connie. I says, Connie, I've got one call after another. I don't have time to talk. She says, I'm not Connie. I says, yes, it is. And she says, how do you stuff a turkey? And I says, you just shove it up your rear end. And she says, what did you say? And I says, shove it up your ass, Connie. Come on, I got calls coming in. She says, this is not Connie. What is your boss's name? And I said, oh, my God. So I had to tell her. And so she says, what's her number? And I had to give her my boss's number, who was sitting behind me. I thought, oh, my God, I've had it. I have had it. Mm. And so she answers, picks up the phone, and she said that girl said, hi, your assistant told me to shove it up my ass. I asked her how to stuff her, and he told me to shove it up my ass. And my boss thought that was so funny. She started laughing, and she couldn't stop laughing. So anyway, it was... And another funny thing, really funny, a girl came walking in with a monkey. And I was in the women's department. I stood up and I saw this girl with this monkey on a leash. And I said, what the heck is she doing with a chimpanzee, And she was going straight to the city editor, who at the time was Bill Tanner. And I thought, what's she doing? So anyway, Bill calls me because I'm standing up laughing myself silly at this chimpanzee. I thought, God, that is so funny. So Bill Tanner sees me standing there laughing, and somebody saw me with one of the photographers had one of those long lenses, took a picture of me and stuck in the paper the next day. But anyway, Bill called and he said, call my number. I want to see what happens here. So I dialed his number and the chimpanzee picked up the phone and went, yin, 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 yin. And I'm laughing myself sick. So then Bill says, okay, hang up. And he had put, because at that time we only used typewriters. At that time, he had put a piece of paper in the typewriter and went like this. And the chimpanzee turned around and started banging on the typewriter. Unbelievable. It was unbelievable.
Did she have an appointment with that chimpanzee?
Well, he was here for the, there was something going on at the zoo. And so she was, you know, wanted publicity. And I'll never forget that.
Funny times.
Yeah, I mean, wonderful things happened at the press. And it was a friendly place.
How so?
Just we all helped one another. And if somebody had a food question, or if they were writing about something that had something to do with the food, they didn't quite know how to present it, they'd come up and they'd say, is this right? Does this look right? Yeah, or no, or whatever. And we just all helped one another. But one time, Marge Algie, who at that time was the society editor, and she was in the women's department, I could see her like this. We became very good friends. And one of the Halleys from the Halley Company, one of the Halleys, who is, I think it was Chisholm, Chisholm Halley, came in. I think she was married to Chisholm Halley. And she came in with this little poodle in a bag and came to Margie and did some story. And so after she left, Margie interviewed her, and after Halley left, Margie comes over, she says, give me a good lead for this story. This is how we helped each other. She said, give me a good lead. And I said, Chisholm Halley's wife came in with the poodle half in the bag. And so she used it. But we used to help one another. At the Plain Dealer, everybody's out for themselves. I mean, that's the way I felt when I worked there.
Mm-hmm. Different culture.
It's a whole different group of people. And
why do you think the publisher said no to press people coming over to the Plain Dealer?
Well, because because newspapers were starting to not go out of business, but they weren't becoming as popular, you know, and they couldn't afford it.
Oh, so you think it was purely economical?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. See, the reason they got me is because I didn't ask for. You know, I had to pay all of my Social Security. I didn't get any paid vacations. I didn't get any hospitalization, none of that. I paid for all that myself. Whereas everybody who worked at the Plain Dealer got their hospitalization was all paid for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And vacations and all that kind of stuff.
That was being freelance.
So I freelanced, yeah. And what I did with that money, like for instance, if if my bill was $500, I would get $500. Whereas when they're taking everything out, Social Security and all this, you don't get $500. You get less. So what I did with that money that I didn't, you know, wasn't taken out, I put it in the stock market. Because I didn't know how long I was going to be there. You know, they said, well, a year, that's it. They never told me not to come back. So I just kept going. But they had always wanted the book and author and the spelling bee, but they couldn't because the press, Cleveland Press, started book and author. They were one of the first newspapers in the country.
What's the spelling bee?
The spelling bee is going on now. In fact, they just had the winner that's going to Washington, I think in May. But all this, we only did 7th and 8th graders. And it was all the schools. I mean, it's not as large now as it used to be. And the winner would go to Washington, and then they'd take tours all over Washington, and then they would participate in the bee. And my best spellers were either Korean, Chinese, or Indian. I got one regular American from Magnificat who was very good. But the ones who are winning the National Spelling Bee, now the one who won here in Cleveland is Indian. Yeah, I don't know why that is. Last year in Washington, the finalists, there were 8 finalists. They were all Indian.
So how are you involved specifically with the spelling bee?
Well, we each year we get books with all the words that were going to be used. And the schools would call me and say, do you have the spelling bee books yet? And I'd say yes, and I'd send them, you know, send them to them. And this one Indian called, because you can understand, tell by their accents. One Indian called and said, when are the spelling books coming out? And I said, why? And he said, well, I have a boy in the third grade. I said, well, we don't do third grade. We only do 7th and 8th graders. He says, yeah, but I want to get them started. So I got his address. I sent it to him, and that kid won the bee. That's all they do.
Were you always with the food section?
No, I went from food section because they started getting rid of people because the afternoon papers were just kind of losing advertising. When you lose advertising, you can't afford to pay anybody. So they put me in the promotion department, and that's where I did the spelling bee, book and author, science fair. We used to throw a party for anybody who'd been married for 50 years. The 50-year anniversary, threw a big party for people who were married for 50 years. We used to throw, and then we start cutting back. And then when they got rid of the society editor, because she was at that time 67, and they were trying to get rid of everybody, so they retired her and asked me to be the society. I said, I don't know anything about society. What are you talking about? What are you talking? Oh yeah, you can do it. You can do it. That was difficult.
What was difficult?
Well, if you look at the society pages today, they're crap. All you see are pictures of 2 people together or 3 people together and their names, and that's it. Well, that's not covering society. I mean, here, these are all these real wealthy people who give money to all kinds of charities and do all these charitable things. And I mean, you went to those parties and you took pictures of them, but you quoted them. There, you read society pages today, nobody quotes anybody. You know, you want to know what somebody has to say. And I got to know some people who gave me good quotes. And I'd go to those people and I'd say, well, what do you think? And they'd say something really funny and I'd write it down. It would be interesting to read. But they don't do that anymore. But that was a challenge because that was really...
Do you remember any specifics there? People you'd go to?
A lot of funny... Yeah, they're dead now. The Josephs. Their son's still alive. Martha Joseph and her husband, I can't think of his first name, but they used to eat at the this one place at the Hannah all the time, and I used to see them. And I could always get something funny from them. Or I'd ask questions like, what kind of people do you stay away from? And one person said, I stay away from anybody who starts a conversation and never finishes it. You know, they start and they're looking around at a party, you know, they're not really talking to you, they're too busy looking. And I don't know, I just ask a lot of crazy questions. But it made good copy, because I thought I'd do it differently than it was done before. And that way you got, the thing about it is you get enough names in the paper so people will buy the paper. And I had like a gossip column. And that's why they have these gossip columns, and they don't do that anymore. And you know, those people want to see their name paper, sales papers.
I was wondering about this trend of people not reading newspapers anymore.
Yeah, I think it's too bad. And you're talking to a real Luddite, because I hate computers. I mean, I worked on them enough times to hate them, because I was getting paid, and the press, when we first came out with them, was the year when we, you know, then finally we went out of business. But they're good for, you know, if you want to look up something, you can always, you know, look up something about somebody, you can find it. That's fine. But I don't like the bad things that you do with it, like child pornography. I don't like that. And I can remember being at the Cleveland Heights Library, and here was this old man on the computer, because they have a whole bunch of computers there, on the computer with child pornography. And I can't tell you what he was doing, but I reported it. And they put a little camera up, and they wrote about it in the paper. But it gets, when it gets into, I mean, a friend of mine, if she wants to know who I voted for, all she has to do is get on her computer, and she'll say, oh, you voted for so-and-so. I don't like that.
How does she know that?
You can't look that up unless you're registered.
I voted.
Right, but are you registered with a party?
No, I'm an independent. Because I don't like any of them.
I don't know how she looked that up then.
She found it. She found exactly who I had voted for.
Huh.
found out. And I don't think that's right.
Yeah, no, you're right.
And, I mean, the stuff that they can find out today,
Yeah.
I don't think it's right at all. I call my former boss up, and I, because he likes his computer. I says, just put my name in there and see what they say. And it had a stuff, you know, on what I had done or something. And I thought, you know, I don't like that.
Yeah.
Like cell phones, I hate those. When I first got a cell phone, one time I picked up my cell phone to call somebody, and there was a conversation on it. I don't know who these people were. There was a conversation between two people. I thought, what's this? What's this all about? That was a long time ago when they first came out.
Yeah. But anyway, I wanted to ask you, though, so when you worked at the press,
mm-hmm.
between offices, between departments, there was a lot of helping back and forth, and you said...
Yes, it was a wonderful place to work.
And when you said when you worked at the PD, it wasn't like that at all. It was more people were looking out for themselves.
Yeah, more, you know, they really didn't have the time.
Sure. But how about you yourself? Take an interest in what was going on, like what the opinion columnists were writing, or in either place?
Well, my closest friend at the Plain Dealer was Mary Strassmeyer, who had do you remember her? Wow.
Well,
you're not from here, no wonder. No, she was the gossip columnist.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and we were competitors, the Plain Dealer and the press. Oh, we were trying to beat the gossip, you know. If you heard gossip and you got it in there, you wanted to be the first one to get it in there. That's just the way it was. And Mary Strassmeyer and I were very close friends. And she was she's dead now. She was a diabetic and nobody knew it. And she was losing her eyesight. Mm-hmm. And I guess she had some kind of a seizure, and I was in the promotion department at the time, and they called me and says, come up to the restroom, girls' room. Mary's up there. She won't allow anybody in there. And I said, why? Well, she's had, you know, she just, so maybe she'll allow you in, find out what happened. And that was when we found out that she was a diabetic and had seizures. Because she worked there a lot longer past the age because she was well-read. I mean, everybody wanted to get in her column. And, like, I would go up, and I knew that she couldn't see very well, and I'd say, no, that's not right. You got that misspelled. This is how you spell it. This is not right. This is not right. And when the one of the Higbee heads of Higbee was retiring, the business department had a story about who they thought was retiring, and it was wrong. And I went up to Mary and I said, hey, they're wrong. I'm going to give it to you right. This is the guy who's retiring, and because I know his wife, you know. So she beat the business department and got it in her column. Oh, yeah. I mean, her job was to beat everybody there. Whatever they covered, if something was happening with a CEO or whatever, it was her job to find out ahead of time and say, you know, it's been rumored that blah, blah, blah is going to leave, you know, Goodyear or whatever. And, I mean, that's what gossip was.
Mm-hmm. You had to have spies.
Yeah. And if I'd hear something or see something, and just because I happened to know the head of Higbee's wife at the time, I knew that that was happening.
Interesting. Well, we're at an hour and 10 minutes. We can keep going.
Oh.
can stop now. We can reschedule. It's up to me, whatever you'd like.
Well, I mean, I don't eat for a while, so.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, we can keep going for a little bit longer.
Oh, yeah, because she was up for 3:30.
She's the last one. Yeah.
Okay. I'm curious what the other factors are. You think that newspaper readership has declined?
Yeah, and I don't like that at all.
Do you have an understanding of why?
Well, because of all the gizmos, the iPods and the iPads and the
computer.
Yeah. And you don't get everything. And, why should you have to bring up on the computer who's died that, you know, bring all that up? I mean, that's one of the first things I read is, do I know anybody who just died? Or, you know, read about that. And there are a lot of things that you just don't get. And the fact that anybody can get on and write something, and you think it's the truth, they could be making up things. There's more of that, you know, misinformation is getting, you know, anybody can be a writer today. You just get on the computer and do, you know, Cleveland.com or whatever.com. You could make up all kinds of stories, get people in all kinds of problems. Whereas in a newspaper, you got to get your facts right, or you're gone. And then, of course, the porn, and child pornography. Where did they get these ideas? I don't get it. I don't understand how they figured out how to do that. And these kids are doing it. Yeah. And Facebook, these kids guys are making arrangements to meet these 14-year-old girls. There's another story in the paper today, you know, on how he raped her. I mean, what is this coming to? There are no morals today, none whatsoever.
Well,
I'm a person, I have very high morals. And except I do swear. That's about the worst thing I can do. But I don't like what young people are doing today. Marriage is going out of style. Living together is in.
Were you married?
Nope. I loved my work more than I loved everybody I dated. I really...
So you were not the norm.
Not really. Well, I don't know. I think the one guy that I really, really, really wanted to marry was transferred to Philadelphia, then New York, and then England. But he was a gentleman enough to write and tell me that he had met somebody in England and he was going to get married. I mean, that's what a nice gentleman he was. But I don't see that many gentlemen today. Mm-hmm. I think, and the women are too aggressive. Way too. I think the women today are the aggressors and the men are the weaklings.
Hmm. Being part of a newspaper,
mm-hmm.
Let's go back to that a little bit. In 1966, when the riots happened in Huff, for example, what was that like?
It was terrible.
On the journalism side?
It was terrible. It was scary. And when you think that these people have to go out there and cover this stuff, today it's worse. I mean, when you think of what's going on in our neighborhoods today, I mean, this is the big cities. There is no safe place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but what about, did they come back with stories? Did they share those stories with you? Those people who were out there covering the riots?
Yeah. I mean, at that time I was doing food.
Right.
I wasn't into the, I was never into covering a fire. I wouldn't know how to cover a fire.
Or, but did they tell you the stories?
Well, I mean, they'd be busy writing them in the paper. I'd read them in the paper. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't have time to all I did was answer the phone.
Right.
300 calls a day because everybody eats.
that's a lot.
What was your schedule, your work schedule?
8 to 5, but I was always there till 5 in the morning. When I did society, I was there till 5 in the morning.
Because
the parties wouldn't, the party would be over with at, midnight? Then you'd come back to the newspaper and try and get your, write it up.
Where
and
was
get
the
it.
Press?
The press at that time that I was there was on 9th and 9th. Not 9th and Superior.
Near downtown.
Yeah, it was on 9th. Wait a minute.
St. Clair or Chester?
Not Chester. It was closer to the lake. The heck?
So St. Clair or?
Is that St.? No, 9th and.
Lakeside.
Lakeside. There you go. 9th and Lakeside.
And how'd you get there?
I drove and parked.
And so you're fine getting to your car at 5 in the morning? Were you the only one in the building?
No.
No, in the paper building?
Well, there was always, there were editors there because they had to take your story. There was always, somebody there because you had to get your story in print.
Were you responsible to have it all printable? Like, did anybody, this is a nuts and bolts question, did anybody proof your writing, the editor?
Oh, sure, they have to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would do it, but if they'd catch a misspelled word or, today, there are so many mistakes in the paper. I every day. And I think, now, wait a minute, what did I just read? Misspell. They don't have time. The plain dealer, they don't have anybody there.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's gone. There's no time to print that. And plus, it's out. I get my paper at 6 o'clock in the morning. That's early. When there's stuff going on till midnight that they want to get in the paper. And they only have a third of the staff there, they're gone. They got rid of everybody. I mean, working for a newspaper today, I would never want to work for a newspaper today. I mean, that you really have to be good, really good. And I wasn't that kind of a writer. I mean, I could, if somebody sent me out to a fire, I wouldn't know what to do. Because that's not the kind of a reporter that I was. But I mean, people who majored in journalism, I mean, they learned all that stuff. I didn't. I didn't take any courses. I wrote about what I knew, food. And I think it's the most rewarding job you could have. But today it's not like it used to be. And I feel sorry for these reporters who have to go out and do all this work. I couldn't do all that. It's just, I don't know.
So what are a few adjectives you'd use to describe Cleveland?
Well, how about what about the when you first came here?
Yeah, it was different.
And now, a few adjectives for that.
Well, it was a lot safer when I first came here. I mean, we had no problem walking. I mean, until I got my car, we had no problem walking from Mayfield down to Little Italy, or over to Russo's on, you know, we had no problem. And today, I don't care whether you live in Chagrin Falls or where you live, there are shootouts. I mean, it's terrible, all big cities. I mean, I love Cleveland because of the Cleveland Orchestra, Apollo's Fire, the Art Museum, City Music, that whole area around the Art Museum with the, you know, Botanical Garden and the science, the whole, I mean, this is a wonderful, wonderful town. But it's scary. I mean, I can't drive anymore, so I don't have to worry about this. But I'd be scared to death to be driving down, like when I used to cover society and come in at, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, or come home at 5 o'clock in the morning or whatever. I couldn't do that. And I'd be scared to death because there's always somebody to, I mean, there's not one day that goes by that there's not a shootout at some bar. You know, they tell you, oh, you can carry your gun in the bar, but don't drink. Well, now, why would you go to a bar and not drink? Does that make sense to you? That's stupid. And this whole gun thing, I don't think anybody ought to have a gun. Nobody except the police, period. I'm against guns. But their guns are in the wrong hands. I mean, look at that shootout at, you know, where the kid shot 20 people. Well, his mother had guns and took them to gun, you know, places where you practice shooting. Take your son, practice shooting, young guy like that, and then he ends up tearing up his school. I mean, come on. No, I just, America is not what it used to be. It's scary. I mean, our freedoms, I can remember my mother, and I never understood what she always knew something before it was going to happen. She had, I don't know, she was very, very smart. I wish I had her brains. But she told me, and this was like, you know, 30, 40 years ago, she said, our freedoms are going to take our freedoms away from us. I didn't know what she was talking about. I said, what does that mean? Well, now I know what that means. We're free to carry a gun, and then there are all these shootouts every night at a bar. I don't care what. There's always a shootout. Somebody gets in an argument, and they shoot each other.
Well,
do you want to say your mother's name?
Harriet.
Harriet.
Harriette.
So all these freedoms will take our freedoms away.
Yeah. And she, I don't know how, she just knew everything.
Sounds like a good mother.
Oh, she was fabulous. She was very smart.
I never heard that before.
Yeah, I never have either. And now I know what she's talking about. Yeah, she died when she was 74 of a stroke, just immediately. One stroke, that's it, bam.
Well,
thank you.
Yeah, thanks for sitting down and talking with us.
Yeah.
Oh, well, it's been interesting. I can't imagine what you're going to do with this thing.
Well, but thanks anyway.